Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Pope's address to the joint session of Congress and speak with best-selling author James Carroll, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University, who is a former priest and anti-war activist, who has been a civil rights worker and a community organizer, and is the author of Christ Actually, The Son of God for the Secular Age, now out in a new paperback edition. We will discuss his recent article in The New Yorker, What to Make of Pope Francis Now, and the Pope's head-on confrontation of thorny political issues bubbling over in the presidential primaries, as well as the pontiff's belief that, quoting him, the Church's structural and organizational reforms are secondary. The first reform must be the attitude. Then we'll look into the kickoff of the state visit by China's leader Xi Jinping, who was visiting the West Coast, where in Seattle he pledged that his country would take action on cybercrime, while cracking jokes about the movie Sleepless in Seattle and the Netflix TV hit House of Cards that portrays a venal, power-hungry U.S. president, a series that ironically is the most popular illegally downloaded show in China. One of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, Perry Link, joins us. We'll discuss how much this state visit is part of an orchestrated propaganda campaign underway in China to bolster and burnish the image of Xi as a world leader and a cuddly big daddy figure. Then finally, we'll speak with Amitai Etzioni, University professor and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University, about the recent evidence of unbridled capitalism that Pope Francis has warned about. We will discuss Amitai Etzioni's article at the Huffington Post, Unbridled Capitalism, New Evidence, as well as the sentencing of a peanut executive whose product killed 9 people and sickened 714 others, and yesterday's resignation by the CEO of Volkswagen because the company deliberately and systematically cheated consumers and the U.S. taxpayer, along with the recent expose of Johnson & Johnson's marketing of a drug they knew caused strokes and abnormal breast development in boys. And joining us now is James Carroll, a distinguished writer in residence at New York University and the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction, a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. Carroll served as a Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974 and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named Best Columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. And his latest book is Christ Actually, The Son of God for the Secular Age, now out in a new paperback edition. And he has an article at The New Yorker, What to Make of Pope Francis Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Carroll.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Ian. Thank you.
And, of course, the Pope addressed the Congress today, and he's taken on some very thorny political issues head-on. He's not shying away from it. But in your piece, in the recent piece in The New Yorker, you talk about something that David Brooks had recently written in a column in the Times, in The New York Times, dismissing the Pope as lacking, quote, a practical strategy for a fallen world. Well, the people that the Pope was talking to today hardly have any strategies. Their only strategy is gridlock and obfuscation. And it would seem to me that the Pope, in raising the consciousness of people about immigration, about climate change, about economic injustice, about the failures of capitalism, I think he's doing a hell of a lot more in terms of strategies than the political class, who are bringing us paralysis.
Well, the beginning of a practical strategy is moral clarity, and I believe, in a way, that is what people recognize in Pope Francis and why they are drawn to him. That the man offers moral clarity. And he does it without the imperative tone of voice, without standing above us on a moral high horse, wagging his finger at us. His call to change is an invitation. It's not a command. So even when he says something that you might be inclined to disagree with, if you, for example, are a banker in Wall Street and you are inclined to disagree with his analysis of global capitalism, still, you have to be chilled by the stark resolution with which this man describes the plight of those billions of people who are being left out of the world market system. When he addresses climate change, there's a way in which his refusal to speak with an imperative tone of voice, but instead he speaks kind of pleading on behalf of a trashed and wrecked planet Earth. There's a way in which people respond, and I think that even politicians in Washington who've already drawn lines on this question, climate change, will be more responsive on the matter than they have been before. Let's see what John Boehner, a Catholic, says on climate change going forward. I would be surprised if we don't see some influence here. This, after all, not every Republican is the stalwart denier that Donald Trump is. And if we can assume a measure of goodwill and authentic concern for the future of the human race, I think that the witness of Pope Francis can be powerful.
But the Pope, a while back when this immigration crisis was beginning to hit Europe, when he described the Mediterranean as a vast graveyard, when he visited the tiny island of Lampedusa between Italy and Libya, where bodies had been washing ashore, he has been on top of this issue. And more recently, he invited every Catholic parish in Europe to take in some of these immigrants coming in from Syria. So,
if that's not a practical strategy, I don't know what is.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Really? I mean, I was astounded, Ian, when I read that, and I was moved by it because it is. And I'd like to. If I were a hands-on reporter, I'll tell you, I would really be trying to follow what happens now in Catholic parishes across Europe. And will the bishops of Europe be responsive to the Pope's instruction? I hope so. It was an invitation. Listen, when I read that, I thought to myself, what would have happened in 1943 if Pope Pius XII had instructed every Catholic parish in Europe to take in a Jewish family? Well, the Holocaust almost certainly would have continued to unfold because of the monster that Hitler was and the grip of power he had over the machinery of his own dictatorship. But the attitude of the broader culture of Europe would have to have been changed. And it was the broader culture of Europe that enabled Hitler to do what he did. It's addressing the broader attitude that Pope Francis has set as his purpose. And it's when attitudes change that doctrines and policies change in train.
And again, I'm speaking with James Carroll, who's a distinguished writer in residence at New York University and the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction, a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York. Carroll served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974 and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named Best Columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award. And his latest book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age, now out in a new paperback edition. And he has an article at The New Yorker, What to Make of Pope Francis Now. And in your article, you talk about how the Pope is in fact the culmination of a slow, if jerky, recovery on the part of the Catholic Church from its self-defeating rejection of modernity. So clearly they were in huge trouble before this Pope, and they were in trouble before the Pope before the last Pope, and the last Pope himself seemed to have dug the hole deeper. He was totally out of his depth, not understanding the crisis of child abuse. So this Pope was clearly needed, but talk about the rejection of modernity.
Well, you know, I refer in that article to the Pope's, to the Church's condemnation of Galileo, which was a defining mistake. Galileo was basically saying that if experience contradicts doctrine, then doctrine needs to be reinterpreted. And at issue was whether the Bible was correct in saying that the sun goes around the earth. And when Galileo insisted that he had data showing the opposite, he basically said that the biblical phrases that seem to contradict this must be reinterpreted. And the authority structure of the church said no. And ever since then, the church has been in a thicket of confusion and denial, really, about the scientific method, about the rationality of faith, about pluralism, about democratic liberalism, about most of what we associate with the post-Enlightenment world. And this has been a cul-de-sac for Roman Catholicism. And the end of the road was reached after the Holocaust, when I think the church began to reckon with its grave mistakes, especially anti-Semitism. And Pope John the 23rd convened the Second Vatican Council in 1962. And that council was the beginning of this reckoning with the mistake the church had made in rejecting the modern world. And Pope Francis has continued the legacy of the Second Vatican Council. I insist that we have to see him in that broader context. So it isn't just that this eccentric outlier from the sort of edge of the Catholic hierarchy has accidentally become Pope. No, he is a part of a larger movement, I would call it recovery, reform, if you will, of the Church from its grave mistake in rejecting modernity.
But at this point, you can't accuse the Catholic Church in general of rejecting modernity in the way that you can, particularly in the context of Galileo, in the way that you can accuse the American evangelical Protestant churches. A Gallup poll came out last year that found 42% of Americans do not believe in the theory of evolution.
Yes. Well, the Catholic Church reckoned with evolution. It was one of the challenges that it had to confront. And in the early to mid 20th century, the Catholic Church in the Vatican did accept the testimony of science on the matter of evolution, and it did precisely begin to do what Galileo had called for. If hard data contradicts the Book of Genesis, then the Book of Genesis has to be reinterpreted. It's that simple. And the Catholic Church accepted that. For various reasons, evangelical Protestantism, in most of its strains, has not accepted it. But that process in the Catholic Church is not finished. And it's not clear yet that the Catholic Church has fully recovered from its fundamentalism. Pope Benedict was a fundamentalist Catholic. And even though he was a supremely sophisticated intellectual, he was not prepared to submit the faith to the test of rationality. And that was part of why his pontificate was limited. My own sense is it's one of the reasons why his decision eventually was to surrender his pontificate and resign. This is an ongoing process of recovery, and Pope Francis is a joyful mark that the recovery continues.
Well, surely he's more than a joyful remark. He's actually a very proactive spearhead, if you will, for science in the form of taking on the issue of global warming. Because it is so blatantly an issue of anti-intellectual deniers up against 99.9% of the world's scientists. And so with the Pope joining the ranks of the 99% of the world's scientists, that is a profound statement.
It's very true. It's very true. And some observers give emphasis to the fact that as a young man, the Pope studied chemistry. He's a Jesuit. It's one of the signals of the importance of his being a Jesuit. The Jesuits are the intellectual treasure of the Catholic Church, with their schools and colleges and universities all over the globe. So submitting the faith to the test of reason comes naturally to Pope Francis, and we're better for it, that's for sure.
And in terms of his stance on immigration, which, as you know, James Carroll, is a particularly contentious, if not rather ugly, issue being raised in this presidential primary debate, along with the Islamophobia, by the way, you know, we have presidential candidates who do not even understand the United States Constitution. They don't know anything about Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. And yet, here they are out making these casual, cruel remarks to huge swaths of humanity. I find this whole environment to be quite disgusting, frankly. And I commend the Pope for just basically pointing out that he's the son of Italian immigrants, and, you know, we should rejoice in...
And he saluted the United States of America for its great tradition of welcoming immigrants.
Exactly.
We are the immigrant nation, after all. It was native peoples who were the first to welcome immigrants to this country. And despite all of the kind of tragic failures of the American political imagination having to do with those native peoples and the Africans who were forced here against their will, despite all of that, the great tradition of this country is that newcomers are welcome. And newcomers find a place, and newcomers build this, have built this country, and continue to build it. And Pope Francis properly salutes us for that. And he also, by his simple way of being, stands shoulder to shoulder with those migrants who are being demonized in the United States today. Just as he stands shoulder to shoulder with those migrants who are being castigated and rejected in many parts of Europe right now. I mean, imagine the outrage it was when officials in Hungary said that they would welcome migrants as long as they were Christian. Excuse me. Excuse me. Pope Francis represents a very different point of view from that.
You just mentioned Native Americans, and of course there's some contention over beatifying Friar Junipero Serra, who we're very familiar with out here in California because of the missions. What's your sense on how the Pope's handling that?
Well, it's a good question. I begin by remembering that in Bolivia, the Pope was quite explicit in, as he put it, humbly asking forgiveness, not only for the offense of the church herself, but also for crimes committed against native peoples during the so-called conquest of America. And you could say that church figures, as he's implying there, including Father Serra, were complicit in that exploitation. So it's a good question. What is it to canonize this priest? I don't know his story well enough. Maybe in California you know it better. I don't know his story well enough, but it certainly raises the question, what were the friars and the black robes, the priests, doing when they advanced the cross of Jesus Christ side by side with conquistadors who are wielding swords in the name of Jesus Christ? It's a shameful chapter in the history of the church. But let me also say that the human history is thick with ambiguous and complicated moral issues. There were priests during the Holocaust who were, on the one hand, anti-Semitic in their treatment of Jews, but who were, when push came to shove, heroic in their defense of Jews in the death camps. That moral complexity reminds us, actually, that no one is innocent. There is no such thing as an innocent nation, an innocent church, an innocent movement. moral complexity goes with the human condition. So if Father Sarah is a signal of that complexity, perhaps he can advance our understanding of it.
Well, just in closing, James Carroll, to the subject of capitalism, which the Pope takes on head on, and certainly nobody much in this country, except for maybe Bernie Sanders on the stump, is willing to critique it. We have a kind of a poster boy for the worst of capitalism, this hedge fund guy that took over a pharmaceutical company and is now jacking up the price of a 62-year-old drug that treats AIDS patients by 5,000 times. And he's been publicly shamed into reversing himself. But I think a critique of capitalism is long overdue.
It's certainly true. It's certainly true. And Pope Francis is not offering an alternative economic model. That's one of the things his critics complain of. But what he is saying is the consequences of this global economic structure are simply unacceptable, because when the vast majority of human beings are simply left out of the world economy, therefore hungry, homeless, ill-clothed, desperate for health care, when that's the consequence of the way in which the world economy is organized, the Pope is right to say this is wrong and it must change. And I do believe he's being heard. I do believe he's being heard.
Well, James Carroll, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I wish you well.
Thank you so much, James, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. And I've been speaking to James Carroll, who is a distinguished writer in residence at New York University and the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. He's a former priest who has been a civil rights worker, an anti-war activist, and a community organizer in Washington and New York, and served as Catholic chaplain at Boston University from 1969 to 1974, and then left the priesthood to become a writer. He was named Best Columnist by the Catholic Press Association and received the first Thomas Merton Award, and his latest book is Christ Actually, the Son of God for the Secular Age, now out in a brand new paperback edition. And he has an article at The New Yorker, What to Make of Pope Francis Now. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the Chinese leader's stage visit to the United States. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Perry Link, who holds the Chancellorial Chair of Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines and is also a professor of comparative literature and foreign languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform students' protest in June of 1989. He was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. Welcome to Background Briefing, Perry Link.
I'm happy to be here.
And apparently the Chinese President Xi Jinping and his wife are happy to be here in the United States. They're on their way, of course, to a state visit in Washington later in the week, but they've been in Seattle, where he met with a bunch of tech magnates. And
yes,
he is actually, in a speech, he made reference not to just to the movie Sleepless in Seattle, but also to the popular Netflix television series House of Cards that portrays this,
yes,
this venal, power-hungry, murderous president of the United States.
Yes.
So what did you make of that?
He prepared clearly for this trip. Before he came, he invited actually a number of American scholars and former officials to come to Beijing to advise him on how to make this trip go smoothly and be impressive, and clearly put in a lot of planning into those things. So I don't think any of the bells and whistles in that wonderful speech that we heard were extemporaneous. They were well planned. It's important to realize that for him, the main point, the most important thing, is not the show he puts on to the world, but how it looks back in China. He's taken some real initiatives and made a lot of enemies and has generated a number of rivals inside China. And for him to be able to come out and show that he can tour the U.S. and get a state dinner and get a 21-gun salute helps his hand politically inside China. And therefore, I view most of this stuff as a well-choreographed show.
Well, of course, in terms of the reference to House of Cards, what was ironic about it was that in this speech that he made in Seattle, the purpose of the speech was largely to reassure Americans that China is going to do something about cybercrime.
Yes.
And that they're going to crack down on cybercrime.
Yes.
And then it turns out that House of Cards is one of the most illegally downloaded shows in China.
Yes.
It's literally the most download. Right. It's 682,000 illegal downloads. So I guess he didn't get the irony of that.
Well, I'm not sure it's irony so much as just this gap between rhetoric and reality that characterizes a lot of the official talk everywhere in the world, of course, but especially in China, where officialese and the official world within which you speak it is almost a separate realm from reality on the ground.
Well, when you talk about how it's playing at home and how concerned he is about how it's playing at home, there has been an amazingly choreographed propaganda campaign to make this new leader, Xi Jinping, look like this cuddly guy, this family man. The Communist Party's official paper, The People's Daily, have released a video of who is Xi Dada. And that's his name, of course, which I guess is, what's that means, uncle?
That's his nickname, yes.
Yeah. And it means what, uncle?
Big daddy, sort of.
A big daddy, right.
Yeah.
And, you know, that he's a wise, resolute president, but a very humble leader. And they've even made a group of musicians even wrote a song dedicated to Xi and his wife, Peng Ruiyan, called Xi Dada Loves Peng Mama.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, you know, he came in at a time when China was already facing some pretty severe challenges internally. The rise of the internet just made all of the society much more refractory than it had been before, hard to control. And then the economy and how to keep that going and the environment and so on. And he came in feeling he had to do something, but he didn't quite know what. I view him as not a great thinker. So he looks around to see what he can do and reaches back to the values and programs of his father's generation. His father was a comrade of Mao Zedong and sincerely believed and pushed things like serve the people and do land reform and so on back in the early 50s. So Xi Jinping has tried, although I don't think he's really going to be able to pull it off, to become another Mao Zedong. And of course, in the Mao era, this was very common, to portray high officials as cuddly and rolling up their sleeves and living with the people and so on, even while they were being very authoritarian in practice. So this is just another reason why I see him as under pressure and much less stable inside China than he wishes to have the outside world take him to be.
So let's talk about Xi Jinping's grasp on the country itself. You said that he's trying to sort of, you know, have this atavistic attempt to reinvent himself as Mao in an age that is well past. As we know, Communist China is probably one of the most capitalist countries in the world, or at least in terms of some of the worst aspects of capitalism. So, you know, my understanding is that he's certainly shaken up the place, but also its very economy is being shaken up. And I'm wondering whether that's related. In other words, going after his political rivals and scaring the hell out of the princelings who are starting to take all their money out of the country, it seems to be having a very bad effect on the Chinese economy. So there seems to be an economic warfare going on there. And is it entirely to do, or is it, how much does it have to do with this idea that somehow Xi Jinping thinks he can roll back the clock in terms of party discipline?
I think he thinks he can roll back the clock and do things that Mao did. I'm not sure even he thinks that he can control the economy that way. The economy has just completely changed since the Mao era, and it's much more dynamic and complex and hard to control. In terms of the recent problems with the stock market, I think it's important to distinguish those from problems in the economy as a whole. There are problems in both areas, but they're different kinds of problems. In the economy, the boom was fueled for decades on the exploitation of cheap labor. I mean, here's a great example of how communist political theory and capitalist economic theory have cooperated. But what's happened now is that that has more or less run its course. The wages have gone up now in China, the bottom wages, to where they're higher than in Vietnam and Indonesia. And simply milking more out of willing labor doesn't work to run the economy anymore. So they have to try to change it to more like a service economy and start doing other things. And they're not adept at doing that. They haven't had experience in doing that. But that's really, in numbers, a much bigger problem than the blip we saw in the stock market. And for all of its dynamic ups and downs, it, after all, involves only about 5 or 6% of the population, small investors and so on. And although it crashed, it crashed compared to where it was in June, but not compared to where it was a year ago. So it's not that major a thing, but it's a very good example of what you just mentioned about Xi Jinping and his confreres not knowing what to do. I mean, it's been a long time since we China watchers have had the sense that really at the top, things are going crazy and they don't know how to handle what's going on.
So in terms of, though, using this anti-corruption drive, which is quite popular because there is so much rampant corruption, but she seems to be using it selectively to go after his enemies. Is he creating more enemies than he is defeating them with his policies?
That's a very good question. He's certainly doing both. He's bringing down rivals and also threatening others directly or indirectly. Even people who aren't yet attacked start to feel a little bit antsy. Am I next? Of course, an anti-corruption program in theory is uniform and across the boards, and even he will say that that's what he's doing. But in fact, he has so far hit people that in the past have been in other of the leadership factions. The question of the popularity of the movement in general is a much bigger, broader question. As you rightly point out, the Chinese populace for decades has been fed up with corruption. It's probably been the most widespread popular complaint in China for at least 30 years now. So whenever a leader comes out and says, we're going to do anti-corruption, and then puts it into practice at the provincial or the local levels, which he has done. You know, a lot of local officials now are terrified to go out for dinner and have a big splurge on banquets that they used to have because they're afraid they'll get cited by this campaign and pulled down. That's very, very popular. Last year, I was at a UN workshop for Chinese activists. These are on-the-ground human rights activists. And at one meal, I was surprised to hear several of them say that things are better for them now under Xi Jinping than they were before. Because when we look at repression in China, the repression of the intellectuals has been much stronger since she came in, and the lawyers that have been arrested and the human rights activists that have been thrown in prison and so on are what we've noticed. But we don't notice that on the ground, some of these people can do more things. And I asked them, why? How can you do more? We're hearing about all of this repression. And they said, because the local level leaders are so afraid of getting charged with corruption that they've pulled back into their shells and therefore created space for us to be active in that we didn't have before. So the whole thing is very layered and complex.
But surely, Perry Link, it's one thing to have a bunch of minor bureaucrats not feel comfortable about having banquets, and at the same time having these big companies like that, a big chemical company that was illegally storing chemicals that just exploded in the worst possible way, and because they were sensitive or they responded to water, nobody was told, so the fire people blew themselves up because they hosed this stuff down and made it even worse. That, to me, is just a nightmare scenario for a country that basically is, in the environmental context, somewhat lawless.
Yes, right. Yeah. Now, what I meant to be saying about the local level, I would say, is pretty pervasive. But when you get to the big companies and the big families controlling the banks and the materials on the ground in Tianjin that blew up and so on, that's where it's selective. The anti-corruption is not systematic there. And I don't think it can be, because if Xi Jinping tries to go after everyone at the top the way he's gone after everyone at the bottom, he'll make too many enemies and somebody will pull him down.
So what do you then make of this cyber pledge, which seems a little bit hard to believe that that's serious, and it does raise the question of the extent to which Xi Jinping is really in. I know he comes out of the military and he's got strong ties with the military, and they're supposedly behind much of this cyber attacks. And you could make the case that there is a kind of cold war going on in cyberspace between the U.S. and China, and we don't know what the U.S. We don't know what the U.S. is doing in retaliation, but I'm sure they're not sitting on their hands. But getting into the Office of Personnel Management and being able to steal all those files, largely because on our side we're so damn corrupt that we hand out all these contracts to these contractors, government contractors, who don't protect the data. It made it easy for the Chinese intelligence people to get in there, to get the bios, resumes, everything, medical data on everybody, every U.S. government employee, including all of our spies. So, but they've also clearly gone after industry as well, and they've gone after patents. They're very aggressive in getting into patents to find out the latest inventions. So they really are stealing the United States blind. It's pretty breathtaking.
I'm anticipating that within a few days we're going to hear some announcement. There have been hints of this in the news already that say the U.S. and China have made a breakthrough agreement on not using cyber warfare to attack the fundamental core interests of the other side or something like that, which sounds wonderful. But when I think of how long it took John Kerry and other U.S. diplomats to negotiate with Iran about inspections about building a nuclear weapon, that same question would have to come up in any kind of agreement. Because how do you, first of all, does Xi Jinping really control everybody that's in the military that might be doing this or outside the military? I don't think he does, and he can't. So that's one problem. And the second problem would be that even if the Chinese government and the U.S. government solemnly pronounced that they had this agreement, how would anybody know who's really checking on it and seeing that these things aren't going to happen anyway? So that's another area where I just think that the fluff and the show of this tour that he's making is something quite different from what we should be looking for on the ground.
So just turning to the broader issue of geopolitics and regional politics, of course, Japan recently renounced or at least revised Article 9 of its constitution, moving away from its post-war pacifist stance. And while it didn't get much coverage over here in the United States, it certainly did in China and South Korea. So it does raise questions about, given that you've already had confrontations between these countries over these various sort of piles of rocks in the South China Sea, or the East China Sea. It makes you wonder whether, how much do you think Chinese, it's not belligerence, they're not belligerent, but they're sort of, you know, throwing the weight around a little bit in the neighborhood. And every time they do that, it seems to have, like Newton's law, an equal and opposite reaction. And,
right. And
if you combine the fact that the Filipinos now want the Americans to come back to Subic Bay,
right.
The Japanese are now saying, you know, Americans can shoot down North Korean missiles from our territory, et cetera.
Right.
And this
right.
kind of stuff makes you wonder whether this alleged Chinese military buildup is actually doing them much good.
I think you're right if you're speculating that they miscalculated a bit what the reaction of their neighbors would be. Again, I've always viewed this question as an issue in domestic Chinese politics more than anything else. After the war, the World War II, Mao Zedong did not go to Nanjing to ask about the Nanjing Massacre. There was no museum, anti-Japanese museum at the time. That popped up in 1985. And in the 90s, there were a few government-orchestrated programs where students were brought in from the universities to throw eggs at the Japanese embassy and the U.S. embassy after we bombed Belgrade and so on, the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. So several times since the 1980s, the Chinese government has stirred up anti-Japanese feeling in order, in my view, to help build nationalism and build the idea that the Communist Party of China is the champion of Chinese nationalism. And I see the argument over the rocks as at least partly that. People say that there are mineral resources beneath the rocks, and that may well be, but it's clearly as well a way to galvanize domestic nationalist sentiment for domestic purposes. We want you to support us, the Communist Party, so we're going to pose as the heroes against the Japanese. But if you play that card without looking well enough at the Japanese and the Filipinos and the others, then you do run the risk of this backlash that you just very well described.
Well, just in closing, Perry Link, you were suggesting that there may be something coming out of this in terms of a cyber agreement. What else do you think they can agree on? You know, that some kind of economic stabilization. I know the Chinese are basically liquidating a lot of their treasuries, but I think they need the cash.
Yes.
It's like the opposite of us. We give quantitative easing, which gives money to the banks, and they're doing the opposite.
Right.
So what's just in the last minute, what do you think?
I think that what happens in the pomp and the circumstance of the official visit and what happens on the ground are very different levels. I don't think that actual agreements and negotiations are going to happen during this 1 week. It's fanfare. It's certainly fanfare on the China side, and I think it's reaction to fanfare on the U.S. side. So I think negotiations over cyber warfare and the economy and the islands in the South China Sea and so on will continue, but I don't personally see it as something that's going to see a breakthrough or some dramatic event during this week, which again is mainly show.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Perry Link.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Perry Link, who holds a Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching Across Disciplines and is also a Professor of Comparative Literature and Foreign Languages at the University of California, Riverside. He's one of the world's foremost experts on China's language, culture, and people, and has translated many Chinese stories, writings, and poems into English. In the 1990s, he edited the Tiananmen Papers, a collection of documents leaked by a high-level Chinese official that helped chronicle the events that led up to and followed the pro-reform student protests in June of 1989. He was blacklisted by the Chinese government in 1996. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into unbridled capitalism run amok.
Started show, eagle soaring, oil flow. You then decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Crime depends from who you stole. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, hitting low. Motion is perpetual. We call jewels to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say by slow. Dudes, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Amitai Etzioni, the University Professor and Director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He served as a senior advisor to the White House from 1979 to 1980, and Dr. Etzioni is the author of 24 books, the latest of which is My Brother's Keeper, A Memoir and a Message, From Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations, Security First, and most recently, Privacy in the Cyber Age. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Unbridled Capitalism, New Evidence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amitai Etzioni.
Thanks for having me again.
And it would seem to me that the evidence is not so much new, it's that it's piling up. Just yesterday, the head of Volkswagen resigned over this outrageous rigging of tests, which defrauded not just the consumers, but the American taxpayer who paid green subsidies for the fact that these cars were supposed to be reducing pollutants, not adding 40 times more than they were registering. You also had the recent jailing or sentencing of an executive of a peanut company whose product poisoned 9 people, and I think something like 714 others were made sick. And then you've had a week ago General Motors paying out $900 million for a faulty ignition switch that killed over 100 people. And about a year ago, Toyota paid out $1.2 billion. And of course, in your article, you mention a whole bunch of other cases. It's pretty hard to keep up, wouldn't you say?
All right, but there are special troubling signs here. So first of all, you refer to 2 penalties, but let's look a little closer. General Motors was fined $900 million, which for them is really a slap on the wrist. It should have been much higher. Fine. And one reason these things persist and in the end do not deter future crimes. The whole idea of punishment is not just to punish the culprit, but also to deter future crimes. They don't, because the penalties are not sized enough. As to the executive of the peanut who was jailed, that is the kind of punishment which very much gets the attention of executives. And indeed, one of the problems was that so far, during the subprime crisis and the whole things, events over the last year, people hiring to forge signatures or mortgages and such, none of these guys went to the bankers or the other people went to jail. Now they take a small guy who has a small company, and he did awful things, but they jump on him. But let's see if any of the CEO of Volkswagen will go to jail or General Motors. So first of all, they keep getting the message that the fines are relatively small, and most of them, if they're big shots, they're going to go home with their golden parachutes, their $100 million stacked away, and enjoy a very, very good life. The other thing which really, and that one is beyond my comprehension, what were they thinking? Put it yourself for a moment, I mean, if you can, I don't know if you can, in the shoes of the executive at Volkswagen. And somebody comes to you and say, you know what, let's play a little trick here. I mean, it's not a part we manufactured, which malfunctioned. We tried to make a good part, but it didn't work out. But who comes and says, let's deliberately fool the testing. What are they thinking? They're never going to come out, that nobody's going to blow a whistle on it, that no employee will tell his girlfriend, which will tell the media. And the same with General Motors. For 10 years, they were hiding that their ignition switch is killing 124 people and wounding some 270. What were they thinking?
Well, but as you point out in your article at the Huffington Post, Unbridled Capitalism, New Evidence, and by the way, of course, the term unbridled capitalism is attributed to Pope Francis, who is, you know, spoke to the Congress today and is definitely somebody who has made some fairly outspoken remarks about the nature of capitalism. But what you mention in your article is this case that the Huffington Post exposed in an investigative piece that found that Johnson & Johnson, the huge pharmaceutical manufacturer, manufactured a drug, Risperdal, which they marketed very aggressively, but they knew all along that this drug caused strokes and abnormal breast development in boys. So can you give us a portrait of, I'm thinking of Hannah Arendt's idea of the banality of evil, that you have these corporate CEOs who, you know, work in these big concrete and glass towers, make these decisions, and then go home to their wives and kids and live a normal life and go to church on Sunday or synagogue on Saturday, and, you know, as though there's a complete disconnect.
But you're absolutely right. The reason I called the article, in quotes, Unbridled Capitalism, is exactly my tribute to the Pope, who speaks openly and clearly about that issue, and whether you're Catholic or not, it's a great credit to him. He really is becoming the most articulate voice of those of us who are concerned about a capitalism which got unbridled and needs to be reined in. It's really capitalism running amok. So we need really to make a distinction here. There are some people who still believe in planned economies, and even the Chinese, though, no longer hold to it. Cuba is probably, North Korea, one of the last ones holding out. But always the idea was that capitalism needs to be restrained. My way of thinking about that is to think about capitalism like nuclear energy. If it's in a well-enforced, strong container, it still has its risks, but it can provide us with cheap energy and less polluting than some other source of energy. If it breaks out of its container, it's really, really dangerous. I think the same is capitalism, a very regulated capitalism, regulated by law, regulated by people who have some ethical limits, some self-restraint, some noblesse oblige, can be a very productive machine which produces a lot of stuff, a lot of people, and not just junk. It provides for new technology, for healthcare, for art, etc., new media. But when it gets deregulated, as we have seen over the last 10 years, when it able to bribe legislators, then you get this unrestrained, unbridled capitalism, which is really destructive in the end to itself.
Well, do you think, though, that there's a certain inevitability that unbridled capitalism ends up destroying capitalism? I mean, if you look at Wall Street and the financialization of our economy, which is now well over 50% of our economy has been financialized, you know, that's all about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. The robber barons of old at least created wealth. So it seems to me that unbridled capitalism is also, in a sense, on a trajectory of self-destruction.
Well, we see one major sign of the coming perfect storm in politics, and that is that both on the left and on the right, a lot of people are very, very angry. True, they're often angry at the government because they don't understand that the government is really today largely controlled by special interests. So people correctly sense that the government is not doing their bidding but somebody else's, and that they can't get a handle on it. And that makes them very, very angry and sometimes desperate. So they either follow a left candidate like Barry Sanders, who I'm not sure can get elected, or an egomaniac like Donald Trump. But there is now a very significant part of the public which is really, really distressed. All it takes now for somebody to open their eyes and to see that it's more Citizens United, the court decision, which allows special interests to basically bribe Congress members, for them to take the next step and demand there's a that unrestrained capitalism will be reined in, beginning with limiting its capacity to bribe members of Congress. So I'm living in Washington. I should add one thing. And I know this sounds harsh, but it's the truth as I see it. Congressmen used to be like call girls. You could come and pay them at the dark of the night, and they would perform for you. Now they become like streetwalkers. They solicit. They spend half the day on the phone calling special interests and asking them to support their campaign. It's not an individual issue. It's a system. You cannot run for office unless you raise a huge and growing number of funds. And, of course, special interest will not keep writing your checks unless you pay back. So if you have at the moment a very corrupt system, the combination of special interests governing, influencing the government, rising anger, and somewhere something has to be corrected, because otherwise that will lead to a major breakdown.
Well, clearly we can't expect our political leaders to do the job that they should do, which is to regulate capitalism and capitalists. But it seems like in the case of this hedge fund guy that bought a pharmaceutical company and then decided to charge 5,000 times more for a 62-year-old drug that treats AIDS patients. He's been sort of named and shamed, I guess, into backing down.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels like we need more than that.
Well, backing down, he said he's going to charge a little less.
Right.
But
right.
They haven't even told us yet. Right. Maybe he's going to charge only $700. But again, before we go to how to get on top of it, think for a moment. This guy was sitting in his office and said, okay, so I bought this company. This pill costs $13.50. I'm going to charge $7.50 for it. What did he think is going to happen the next day? So we need, first of all, to have people have some conscience, some self-restraint. They can make tons of money without going that crazy. So that's the first step. Because historically, there were some Rockefellers and Morgans and such who ended up after doing plenty of evil stuff, trying to support the community, trying to support the arts, trying to support even like Gates now, fighting his disease and such. But when it becomes completely raw, completely unrestrained, it's just in the longer run, it cannot be sustained.
Well, Amitai Etzioni, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amitai Etzioni, who's a university professor and director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies at George Washington University. He served as a senior advisor to the White House from 1979 to 1980. And Dr. Etzioni is the author of 24 books, the latest of which include My Brother's Keeper, A Memoir and a Message from Empire to Community, A New Approach to International Relations, Security First, and most recently, Privacy in the Cyber Age. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Unbridled Capitalism, New Evidence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.